Our second contributor making a proposition this morning is Jeff Fagan, who, contrary to the pink revised document, is actually a professor of law. Is that right? Did you get that right? And public law at Columbia University. Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you for having me come and talk to this group. New York has been a place that has had recurring episodes of crime and violence for really since its inception, since its for over two centuries, almost over three centuries. But none of these have been quite as dramatic as the events that happened in the past 40 years. This is a picture of homicides. We focus on homicides to describe crime problems in New York because it's really the most reliably measured and stable measure of crime. And you can see that the epidemics that began in the late 1960s, there are pretty much three of them, one, two, three, this being the 1990. These epidemics are really more gun violence than any other form of violence. And it's very important to note because the conversation really about crime in New York and nationally was a conversation about crime generally. But if you actually look at these data nationally, you see the same picture. This was three specific episodes of gun violence. Here you can see a similar set of numbers about robberies and assaults and burglaries in New York during the same period of time. And you can see the steady decline in burglaries, a bit of an epidemic pattern in robbery, and assaults having a much lesser epidemic pattern. But the real growth industry over the same period of time was in drug arrests by the police. And if you actually get, I'm sorry that you can't see the scale. These are 500 arrests per 1,000 per 100,000 persons, 1,000, 1,500. So this is a lot of people being arrested for drug crimes in the city of New York during this era. We also, in our research at Columbia, did we disaggregated robbery, burglary, and also assault by gun versus non-gun crimes, and you actually get the identical picture. The identical picture shows that, in fact, all of the increase and all of the decline in all three of those crime categories were attributable to gun crimes, not necessarily to other forms of crime. Incarceration was a growth industry during the same period of time. Beginning in 1973, the number of persons incarcerated grew quite dramatically. This is probably a wonderful example of, I think, what Bruce called yesterday as an anti-urban agenda, because all of the growth in construction was in the southern tier of New York and well upstate New York near the Canadian border. This is the daily populations, but the number of prison admissions actually went up during the same period of time quite dramatically. And in fact, during this last period of time, between 1990 and 1999, crime declined in New York by roughly 50%. But the number of new prison admissions declined only by 19%. So there seems to be something a little bit more systemic and recurring. And much of that is attributable to the structure of the laws that mandate incarceration on a second arrest. So if you go back a slide and look at all those drug arrests and then look at this population and think about the structure of sentencing, it becomes quite obvious about how there's an engine that's producing an incarceration problem having to do with drugs that has very little connection to the real crime problems that people face in New York City. Here's a picture of homicide in New York distributed spatially. None of these problems, of course, were distributed randomly. There was a general perception during the crack epidemic of the late 1990s, the early 1990s and late 1980s, that crime was a random phenomenon. People were likely to be shot anywhere. As it turns out, these are hardly random patterns. These are neighborhoods that had some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city, and they're predictable in the South Bronx, in Harlem, in Washington Heights, Brownsville, Bushwick, and Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. Severely socially excluded, disadvantaged neighborhoods. By 2000, things had changed quite dramatically, and you can see the recession of homicide as a general problem, but in fact, the same neighborhoods that suffered then suffer now just to a much more reduced scale. And so This is the crime problems and security issues that New Yorkers face are issues that really are concentrated in specific neighborhoods. And they're very spatially concentrated and call for solutions that I think do reflect the unique problems in those neighborhoods. I want to say a couple of things quickly about race and immigration. One can't have a conversation about crime in New York City or any other American city for that matter, or in London, as I understand developments there, without talking about race. And the efforts of legal institutions in New York to control problems of crime created a racial breach which was really quite severe. If you look at poll numbers about distrust for the police, willingness or lack of willingness of populations to participate and cooperate with the police in investigations, you see these numbers dramatically divided racially around the city. And so even though the neighborhoods that showed the greatest reduction in violence and crime often were minority neighborhoods and enjoyed the benefits of this, somehow there was something tactically about how the crime rates were reduced that led to a fairly strong racial divide. And in fact, things got so bad that by 2003, litigation against the New York City Police Department had produced a court decree, and without admitting wrongdoing, as they say in court orders, the police department signed a consent decree where they agreed to prohibit the practice of racial profiling. And one thing that's very important that we've noticed in New York, that's important for cities around the world, and that certainly is well observed in cities all over the U.S., at least five cities can show the same kind of trend in when you look at panel data on homicides and run some models on this, which is that the neighborhoods with the highest concentrations of immigrants tend to have fairly low homicide rates. And this is really very, very important. There is something about first-generation immigrants which seems to be protective, all other things being equal, against homicide patterns. So I think the lessons about the spatial concentration, I want to draw these lessons very quickly and show you two case studies. The lessons are fairly straightforward. It's an ecological phenomenon that's concentrated in poor neighborhoods, security issues. Sociologists who will recognize the words of Albert Hunter about thinking about how in each community the ecology is drawn within three sectors, public, private, and parochial. That there are opportunities to transform space through zoning and investment, and we'll talk a little bit about how that worked in two places. And that, in part, the increase in by creating a stakeholder interest bringing security down to a level, raising security up to a level where people see some payback from rule of law, this, in fact, increases the legitimacy of legal institutions and encourages citizens to participate in social regulation and control. This is very essential because to have a social regulation system that relies exclusively on legal authorities without the active co-production of security by citizens is doomed to fail. And one of the stories that we see in New York in the two neighborhoods I'll show here are stories that really get to that last point. So, two case studies very quickly. One is the South Bronx. Everybody knows the story. Most people know the story of the South Bronx, but I think it's worth telling for our guests who are not New Yorkers. The area we're talking about is in here. It's very heavily residential. These are some photographs. My archivist, Jessica, is back there. I promise to give her some credit. These are pictures of the South Bronx of the 1970s after the Great Burn. I don't know if you can make this out, but these are two women holding children running out in their nightgowns or bathrobes out into the street as their building burned. A woman entering a shooting gallery. President Carter visited in 77. Some Hiroshima survivors visited in 78. And presidential candidate Reagan visited in 1980. None of them did any good or were able to produce important changes. You can get a sense about the way the neighborhood looked then and now, and you can see that public assistance declined quite dramatically, or modestly, I wouldn't say dramatically. Total number of persons assisted, percent of the population went down. But the real big action was in the decline in public assistance, in part because of the restructuring of the program, but in part because of the change in the population mix in the neighborhood. This was the strategy that was pursued. It was housing, primarily, to be rebuilt on the open spaces. Zoning was changed to encourage mixed development, but mostly single. It allowed for a much more diversified form of housing. There was some attention to a broken windows disorder kind of theory, which was to remove the signs of disorder that, in theory, cue people to commit crime. That theory is in dispute, if not disrepute, these days. there was a very strong emphasis on the conversion of public space into private space. And there was a great deal of stakeholder growth. And the stakeholder growth came from both having ownership of homes in the neighborhood, but also from a change in the population mix. These were people who were moving, who had ownership and a great deal of interest and investment in making the neighborhood work. So this is the South Bronx today. This is Charlotte Street and Boston Post Road, for New Yorkers who don't recognize the coordinates. There's the Pathmark Shopping Center with a number of chain stores. There's a Foot Locker in there someplace and a couple of other places that you'll recognize. This is the housing developments. This street corner could be in any suburb of New York City, or certainly in some of the outer boroughs, particularly Queens. But this is the South Bronx in the same area. And these are the crime trends. The crime trends were going down somewhat unevenly, and then as the development began to kick in the latter part of the decade of the 1990s, things began to change quite dramatically. So this is a story about the transformation of the physical space and, to some extent, the transformation of the investor space. Red Hook is the second story. Red Hook is a neighborhood. This is Red Hook in here, well below the Gowanus Expressway, which is over there. This is public housing in Red Hook here. 80% of the population lives in public housing. The rest of it is mixed use. Red Hook's an interesting neighborhood. It has a very long history of crime problems, a very long history of drug problems. During the heroin epidemics in New York, which really wreaked a lot of havoc in the 1960s, Red Hook was one of the main landing points, in part because the drugs came in through the shipping traffic that was still active there at that time. It has a long history of government investments, of sort of low-level investments in social programs. And in fact, when we were doing field work in Red Hook, people would often say to us, this is just another government program. We've seen them come and go over the years. And that story will become salient in a second. Red Hook is not strictly part separated. It shares in its community district with some very well-off neighborhoods, Carroll Gardens, Cobble Hill, et cetera, and my neighborhood, which is right up there. But it also, nevertheless, has enjoyed the same kind of transformation. Now, it's a place that's been identified as an opportunity for gentrification, and indeed gentrification is happening quite rapidly and quite strongly. There are warehouses that are being taken over and transformed into artist lofts. Big box stores that are being built. Some people are very happy about this. Some people in the neighborhood are very unhappy. I think whether they turn out happy in the end will depend on employment prospects. And it is a contested area. So just quickly, Jessica, I want to give credit to her for standing in the very coldest day of the winter taking these photos. This is the expressway that divides Red Hook from the rest of Brooklyn. This is a public example of public housing where 80% of the population in the neighborhood lives, almost exclusively black and Hispanic. These are the services. There's nothing quite like the Pathmark Shopping Center up there, check cashing stores, liquor outlets, 99-cent stores, and the like. Here's a good illustration of how security concerns interfere with regular everyday space. This is hardly uncommon throughout the Red Hook area. And here's an example of the contested land. This is waterfront land. These are not developed yet, these warehouses. I'm not sure if this is a rail line or not. And the views of the harbor are absolutely magnificent. So you can imagine how this is now contested territory. These are some of the stores that have popped up to service the artists and other incoming gentrifying populations. And so there's an extraordinary tension in the neighborhood around these questions. So the development strategy that seems to have gone on there was not a transformation of the physical space, although that's happening in any event. What's happening with respect to the poor people who were the victims of crime most often, and often the perpetrators, was a transformation of the socio-legal space. And the socio-legal space was changed in large part by the creation of a court, a decentralized community court that exists physically in the area. It combines housing functions, a family court and a juvenile court, and a criminal court. Social services are built into the building, and they're designed to remediate the underlying problems of people who come to those courts. Whether they work or not is a long, complicated story, which we're writing now. It's a very difficult thing to mount services and make them real and effective and legitimate in those neighborhoods. And the real leveraging strategy was by bringing the community into the creation and operation of the court. There was an attempt to create a legitimacy of the criminal law to the most disenfranchised populations that, again, would motivate them to participate in the processes of social control and regulation. And this is the court itself. The court was built in a rectory, an empty rectory of a church. It's about a block away from the housing projects, and it actually is a magnificent building and a really beautiful structure and a well-done effort. Whether the effort turns out is a sociological question we hope to answer in the next year. Nevertheless, the data do show that as gentrification began, things started to change. The court opened right around at the tail end of this, so I think they have a bunch of priors on their side as far as keeping crime down. And if you run the time series out a little more, we know that crime rates still are going down in that area. So the moral of the story is that, first of all, things should probably happen at the spatial level. These are development strategies that that were pursued in neighborhoods around the city. We were going to talk about Times Square, you dropped it. But these are the ways that the systems work. And again, thinking back about Albert Hunter, it's the synergy of the three sectors and their intersection and their mutual activities that seems to promote social control and increase citizen participation in social regulation. And the last thing I suppose I want to say is beware of overreaction. If you think back to the incarceration slides and the fact that the police department's under a consent decree, that's very unfortunate and probably was avoidable. And so overreaction is really quite critical. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff, and again for keeping perfectly to time.